fresh. What? Keep it fresh.
Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a podcast spotlighting women in Baltimore. It all started with a story about a Pegasus. Stacia Brown has been writing her whole life, and though she received an MFA in fiction, she's developed her freelance career on the strength of her nonfiction work, most often in the form of commentary on race, current events, and pop culture. In addition to writing a weekly column for the Washington Post's Act 4 blog, Stacia pens pieces for national outlets like The Atlantic, The Nation, BuzzFeed, Vulture, and The New Republic. Stacia also hosts and produces a podcast, which just wrapped up its first season, called Baltimore, The Rise of Charm City, in which both public figures and lesser-known residents weave oral histories of some of the city's overlooked stories. The first episode, for example, focuses on the Shake and Bake Family Fun Center, a roller rink and community hub in Upton. Stacia talked about reacting, sometimes too quickly, in the aftermath of police shootings and tragedies, her responsibility to Baltimore when she writes for national outlets, feeling like an outsider, and stepping away from writing about her personal life. Here's our conversation.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So where are you from originally?
I'm originally from Lansing, Michigan, but I was raised in Baltimore from the age of 4.
What brought your family to Baltimore?
My grandmother came first, and she was here to pursue court reporting, stenography opportunities, and she got one here. And then my mother came with me a year later. So.
And what has kept you in Baltimore this time, or have you ever left?
I've left a few times. I went to undergrad in D.C. at Trinity Washington University, which was called Trinity College when I was there. And then I went, I came back here. Then I went to grad school at Sarah Lawrence. So I lived there for 2 years, and I lived in Grand Rapids for 4 years after that. I was an adjunct professor, adjunct instructor. So, and then I came back here, and I've been here since then.
And at Sarah Lawrence, did you study fiction?
I did.
Okay, yeah. So you
have an MFA in fiction.
You've done nonfiction, fiction, journalism. Yeah, why the MFA in fiction?
Fiction is really esoteric to me. It's the thing that I don't understand how to write. So I felt like I'd benefit most from training in that. But then right after I graduated, I stopped using the fiction training. I've just done all nonfiction since then, pretty much. So it's useful to me in the nonfiction writing, the things that I learned at Sarah Lawrence, and I'd like to get more fiction writing experience, but it's still something very hard for me to do. It's just difficult for whatever reason.
What kind of fiction were you writing?
I was trying to write short stories, so my thesis was 4 long short stories, and all of them in workshops, they would say, this seems like it could be a novel, and so I decided that I probably needed to pursue longer form fiction. But I don't have time to do that. So that's been the issue with the fiction writing. I think I'd probably be better served as a novelist than as a short story writer because I'm long-winded. But I just haven't had time. So it's been difficult.
I'm always amazed by people who write fiction and nonfiction because I cannot do fiction. And most of the journalists I know don't have, you know, that side of the brain operating. How did you find that nonfiction was your strength, or what worked best for you?
I think it was just by accident, and a lot of it came about because I started with poetry in high school, and then I grew out of poetry in undergrad, and I always did want to pursue fiction. And when I first started writing in like 3rd grade, it was short stories. So I felt like if I was going to get a degree in creative writing, it should be in fiction. But then when I got the teaching job, it was composition. So I was teaching like 1st year students and 3rd year students either composition writing or business writing. So it was all nonfiction work that I was doing in terms of instruction. And it just made sense for me to be doing nonfiction work because I was teaching nonfiction work. So I don't know. I just started to like comment on social events and things like that on a blog that I had. And people started to ask me if they could repost the stuff, like larger publications. And that is pretty much how I got into nonfiction. It was kind of by accident.
So you've always been a writer?
Yes. Yes.
Do you remember the first thing you ever wrote, or when it clicked to you that you knew you wanted to be a writer for your career?
Yes, I wrote a short story about a family of Pegasus is Pegasi. When I was in third grade, and they had like, you know, jewels for eyes, and they were winged, I think. Yeah, Pegasuses are winged, right? So yeah, it was that kind of story, and it was on loose leaf, and it was stapled. I tried to make a little binder out of it, but yeah, that was my first short story experience, and I gave it to a teacher, and I was very serious about it, and the teacher encouraged my interest, and it went from there.
So now you are a full-time freelancer.
Yes.
Well, with consistent jobs, right?
Yes, for the most part, I am a full-time freelancer, and I actually considered the teaching freelance too, because adjunct work is contractual. Like, most work that I've done professionally has been contractual.
How did you get to a point when you could be full-time freelance, and did you have full-time jobs before that?
I had one full-time job, two, actually. So when I got out of undergrad, I was a proofreader for a now-defunct ad agency on Exeter Street. So I was doing that for 8 months, and then I got laid off, and then I temped for quite a while. My second long-term job, I worked for, I think, 4 years, and it was writing a newsletter for a comic book company in Timonium. So I did that for quite a while. Then I went to grad school, and since then, it's all been contract work.
I mean, it seems like the hustle is real when you're a full-time freelancer. How do you make that work for yourself?
It's really difficult, and it's kind of feast or famine. So sometimes I'm able to support myself fairly easily, like I have for the past year. And then sometimes it's really, really difficult. So it has its benefits. As a parent, especially, it has its benefits. So my child is small. She's 5. She'll be 6 in August. And that's been probably the best thing about being a freelancer, being able to take her to school and pick her up from school and to spend time with her during a day. But I do that at the expense of earning a lot of the time. So it's difficult and challenging, but it's also really rewarding.
What are some of the misconceptions you think people have about writing or about full-time freelancing?
Just that it's easy and that you don't do a whole lot and you kind of get to make your own schedule and flit around from place to place and be, you know, really capricious and free-spirited, but you really, that's not it at all. It takes a lot of business acumen that I don't necessarily have. So I've had to teach myself a lot of that kind of stuff, accounting and invoicing and things that, you know, I'd rather not be doing. And that's probably the most difficult part of it. You can sort of make your own schedule, but you're also like, when you're in that schedule making experience, you're up when you don't want to be up and you're down when you don't want to be down.
And it seems like it's probably harder to turn it off. You're not leaving an office at the end of the day. It's like you are beholden to yourself.
Absolutely. So you're always working and pitching or running after a story or interviewing people. And it's just a lot of nonstop work. And there's always something outstanding, or you feel like you need to be, you know, earning more, so you're trying to work more, and it's very difficult, and you don't like necessarily get to take vacations or anything like that. So it's a challenge. It is.
Is this the life you imagined for yourself? And when you were young and wanted to be a writer, what kind of direction did you see that taking?
I think when I was young, I just had that same dream, every aspiring writer has is that you're going to earn a lot. You're going to sell, you know, manuscripts and be able to live off your earnings with your book publications. And that's absolutely not been the case. I've never published a book. So I'm proud that I'm able to earn a living at this work. It's the work that I trained for both in undergrad and grad school. So being able to use the degrees that I have has been an honor. And it's something that not a whole lot of people get to do, but it does look very different than I thought it was going to look.
A lot of the topics you write about include race, motherhood, pop culture. Were those always the topics that have interested you, or how did you kind of like establish those as your beats or become known for those kind of things?
Motherhood didn't interest me very much, but the rest of the stuff definitely has. Pop culture has been a passion of mine since I was a child. I'm glad that I get to write about that. Race is just something intrinsic to like my living experience, so it's easy for me to write about that. I didn't necessarily want that to be a beat, but it becomes a beat because people need people to write about race, you know? And I feel like I can do it in a way that does justice to the topic, so I don't mind doing it, but I didn't set out with an intent for it to become a beat. It just has sort of organically.
Do you encounter the frustration that people come for you just for your take on any kind of incident that has you know, a race component, they're like, oh, you're responsible for writing about this now. Do you run into that?
I ran into that a lot when I first started freelancing in terms of writing essays, think pieces, and that was about 3 years ago. So if I was writing for a particular publication and they didn't have a staff writer who was Black or of color, they would probably outsource that, and it would be, I'd be one of their roster people that they'd ask. And initially, I would always take the work because I needed the experience and the bylines and everything. And you get to be more selective as time goes on, and you get to determine what you want to write about and what you don't. At least I hope that you do. I have. That's not everyone's experience, and not everyone gets to decide. But eventually I did get to decide. So that's been useful for me. I don't get it as much anymore, though. And I still do from time to time, but I don't get it as much. People will ask me to write about different things, or I'll pitch things that aren't necessarily related to race and they'll be accepted, which is good.
What are the things you want to write about most right now, and the things you want to move past?
It's hard to answer that because I don't know that there's anything that I want to write about more than anything else. And like yesterday, I had a deadline, and I have a hard pop culture deadline every week, and I write about that. So I know I'm going to be writing about something related to culture or pop culture specifically. And then I also wanted to write responses to the things that have been happening in the past few days in both Minnesota and Baton Rouge. So I wrote about that on my blog. I didn't want to pitch it anywhere. I just wanted to write about it from an emotional space. And the stuff that I write on my blog is like more like, I don't know, prose poetry type stuff. And I don't like to pitch that kind of stuff. So before a couple weeks ago, I wasn't really updating my blog at all for like almost a year. It was a very long time, unless it was just updates about other places I've been writing or other things I've been doing. And I decided that it was probably time to get back to that type of work because it's a cathartic outlet for me. Yeah. So I did that. And when things occur, when I go to the movies, when I'm watching a show and I know that I'd like to maybe review it or recap it or something like that, then those are things that I pursue. It's just all kind of, I don't have any intentionality about what I want to write topic-wise, but I do always want to be writing. So it's a weird, just kind of a weird thing. And it's something that I think you get to be as a freelancer, sort of more all over the map in terms of your content, which is good in some ways. And you're not beholden to a specific publication, so you can kind of write broadly about a lot of different topics at a lot of different places, which is another benefit of the freelance experience.
Do you avoid pitching those cathartic, emotional pieces just because you don't want to be beholden to an editor? Or can you tell me about how you distinguish a personal piece of writing versus something that you're pitching?
Yeah, I wanted the piece that I wrote 2 days ago, I wanted it to go up when I wanted it to go up, and I didn't want any other lines edited by anyone other than me. So when I'm blogging, I'll probably go back in and change some things as I reread it, or as someone lets me know that I've made a typo or that there's a grammatical error or something like that. The reason that there are typos and grammatical errors is because I'm just kind of free writing, and I value that so much. I value that experience. That is pretty much why I don't pitch them. So you don't know when they're going to go up. You don't know how timely they'll be once someone has started to, you know, line edit them for you. And I definitely value editors and line editing. But in the moment, when you really want to respond to something, it can be, for me, it can be a detriment to wait.
We've spoken in the past. I interviewed you for a series I was doing about kind of prominent Baltimore Twitter personalities, because you have a lot of Twitter followers. And I only moved to the city a year and a half ago, so I kind of, you know, found people in Baltimore via Twitter in a lot of ways. One of your pieces was inspired by Twitter, you told me, and it feels especially apt today. It was called Why I Facebook Stalk Dead Black Teenagers. We're speaking right now the day after the fatal shooting of 5 police officers in Dallas, after a protest sparked by the police shootings of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile. Can you tell me more about that piece and about writing in the aftermath of tragedies and fatal police shootings?
Yeah. So the first things that you find out after you find out the initial tragedy, you find out through Twitter about people who know the deceased. You find out about people who were on the scene at the time when the events occurred. And it's important to sort of figure out who was there, who was impacted, and to figure all those things out before you start to develop a response to them. That's what I do. I'm not a journalist in the sense that or a reporter in the sense that I, you know, show up at the scene of something and get an account from people who are there. Twitter is a way of doing that work for other reasons. So if you're a commentator, you're a blogger, you're someone who writes creatively, being engaged with the things that are going on in the world is important to you. And social media is an important way to do that. And it's a way that you can explore what's occurring in ways that are beneficial to whatever writing that you're going to do or whatever emotional or intellectual response you're going to have to the situation. It's a way for you to develop that apart from what's being reported or in addition to or in tandem with what's actually being reported in press. So you don't know what's going to emerge about the victims in a situation like this. And there are obviously vulnerabilities that citizens, civilians have when they are the victims of these kind of things that people in authority aren't necessarily privy to. So yeah, when something bad happens and a person's in authority, the first thing that investigators or reporters are going to do is to talk to emotional, sympathetic people about them, I think, as opposed to finding their mugshots or finding their police records or finding out what they've done wrong to be put in a situation like this. And in instances where there's a civilian that's particularly vulnerable to that kind of nitpicking and investigation, I like to look at their personal Facebook accounts or their personal Twitter accounts and to discover what kind of person they were in their day-to-day life, apart from whatever is unearthed about them and their flaws. I do the same kind of work with people in authority. So I'm looking for their personal family pictures or looking for what they cared about or what kinds of things they commented on publicly. And it helps me to emotionally connect with what's happening. I don't think everybody needs to do that. I don't advocate it for everybody or endorse it for the average person, but I like to do it to develop my own opinions about people and to flesh them out. So whatever is coming up about someone in the press or what the initial things are, you know, like sometimes people report immediately, this person was at fault, this person had a gun, this person sassed the cop, this person like didn't comply, you know, and apart from not complying or having a gun or whatever the civilian has done, so to speak, I want to know what kind of person they were, where they went to high school, where they worked, were they married, did they have children, who's being impacted by this, who's caring about this alongside me, you know, like, and why, what kind of person was this. Facebook and social media is like the only way that you're going to get that information. Before those things existed, we didn't know anything about people who were killed except that they were killed and whatever was reported about the circumstances surrounding that. And the same is true of police officers. So if you or anybody, army vets, anybody who does a crime, anybody who is impacted by or the victimized as a result of a crime that's occurred, regardless of who they are, we all need to have some sort of personal connection to them, I think, or to find a personal link to the people.
Do you always feel a responsibility or an urge to write in the aftermath of these tragedies? Because, you know, it seems like sometimes you just want to feel, not you, but just in general, people want to feel helpless and hopeless and throw their arms up and not react for once because these are becoming so commonplace.
I don't always feel the urge to write about it, not at all. So sometimes I feel a particular pull to, and sometimes I just don't. Like, silence is also valuable, and being able to privately process what's happening or to choose not to publicly comment on things is also really important. And something that I've learned as a freelancer is that you shouldn't be quick to comment on things, like not in the immediate aftermath, especially if you're doing it in a way that is sort of speculating about what occurred. So if you are researching the person and you're talking about things that you can prove, like where they went to school, who their friends were, that they played for the football team, that they were cheerleaders or something like that, those are things that are useful to you to know, like, what society has lost as a result of this person passing away or being injured. And those are the things that I try to gravitate toward in the immediate aftermath of a tragedy, whether I'm writing about it or not. So, yeah, I definitely don't about everybody, but sometimes it feels like it's hard not to.
How did you learn that skill? Did you ever make the mistake of, in your opinion, reacting too quickly?
Absolutely. So I've done that on my personal blog probably more than I've done it for a publication. I remember when Philip Seymour Hoffman died, I wrote a piece about that and the way that the news was broken on social media. Someone was like live tweeting from the crime scene and they were publishing the tweets. It was like a publication. And I wrote about that and I got one of the details wrong. So that was like one of the time details wrong in terms of how quickly they broke the news. And I was like, I don't want to be the person who gets things wrong, like on a national level. So I always try to reserve a little space now and allow myself not to be the person who is responding to breaking news immediately as it's breaking, but like someone who gives it a 48-hour buffer, if possible. And that is probably the value of not being a breaking news type journalist or reporter.
After the death of Freddie Gray and the unrest in Baltimore last year, did you have national people turning to you for your pieces and for your takes?
I did. I wrote for The Nation and New Republic. I think that may have been it. I wrote five pieces that week, I think. But definitely two of them were national. I think the other ones might have been on my blog.
Did you feel any kind of obligation to represent Baltimore in a certain way or be a voice of Baltimore?
I did. And this is something that I deal with in the podcast that I'm producing too, but I live in the county. I've always lived in the county. I try not to misrepresent myself as someone who lives in the city. I think the issues that both of those communities face are very different. I think there are a ton of communities within Baltimore City that are very, very distinct, and I don't necessarily have encyclopedic understanding or knowledge of them, and it makes me feel as much sometimes of an outsider as people who come from outside to report, outside of the entire Maryland area to report. So I did feel a distinct responsibility, and I asked friends who grew up in the city to help me with that. So it was, it's something I definitely needed to consult people who were more directly impacted than I feel like I am about that type of stuff before I went and tried to cover it or write about it or respond to it.
Well, the fact that you know the difference between Baltimore City and county, I think, proves that you're not quite an outsider.
I always feel like one, though. I feel like I don't, people can tell that I wasn't born here, even though I was raised here. When I go to the city, they can tell by the way that I speak that I'm
really
not, yeah, I'm like not from the city. And, I always tell them up front I'm not, and I don't know. I didn't start driving until I was 29. And so I really didn't know the city at all. Like, I didn't go very much except for tourist purposes or church or like things like that. So it wasn't like I knew communities very well, but you do know, you absorb some stuff, as you grow up in proximity and close proximity to the city. But I don't feel uniquely qualified to report on it. So when I was starting to be asked to do that after Freddie Gray, and in fact, The Nation asked me to go to the funeral, which was not something I would have done on my own. So I went and I was able to report on it. But as soon as it was over, I left and I went back home. And like maybe 2 hours later is when the Mondawmin situation began. I didn't go back out like to Mondawmin to see what was going on. I feel like if that were my community or I were like a breaking news journalist, I would have felt an impulse or an instinct to get back out there and to start asking people things and trying to figure out what was going on. And I didn't. So I was like, I'm commenting on the loss of this person's life. I'm going to come home and sit with what I just experienced. And then I was like, I didn't want to get back out there and do that again. And so as a freelancer, you do get to do that kind of decision making. And that's useful for me. It's a protective thing for me. But sometimes it makes me feel, I don't know, weird not to feel an impulse to be on the scene, on the ground when someone's protesting. Or it makes me feel weird to be able to retreat to the county when something's going on instead of like, being someone who lives there and has no place to go and has to sort of experience this in real time and be impacted by it. And there's no choice involved.
So it seems like you're a kind of stay in your lane writer. Is that fair?
I try to be. Yeah, mm-hmm. I definitely try to be. And I also try to refer other people when I can. So I don't know very many city writers. If there are city writers listening and you want to be referred, I do give referrals very, very freely. You can ask all my friends. So if I feel like I don't know enough about a subject to write about it in a way that is fair and in a way that is accurate quickly, I will refer it to somebody else.
What do you think the national media got wrong in the aftermath of Freddie Gray's death, or what do they get wrong about Baltimore in general?
I think the thing that people mostly got wrong about the Freddie Gray incident on a national scale is that that's something that's going to happen every time something related to Freddie Gray happens. So, for instance, national media always tries to return here when the verdicts are due on the trials for the officers. And they're like, you know, police are out anticipating another riot or whatever. Like, they're, you know, that situation wasn't sparked by the Mondawmin situation wasn't necessarily sparked by the death of Freddie Gray. It was sort of a lot of things that were happening. And people seem to think that what happened had to do just with Freddie Gray, or it had to do with a lot of things that were happening over the decades here, which means that it's a powder keg situation that's going to explode several more times as things related to that incident resurface here. I felt like that was extremely isolated, and I do feel like the frustrations are very real. The frustrations are long term in the communities in Baltimore City, but we don't riot here. Like, that's just not something that we do on a regular basis or that we're going to do annually or monthly as things happen. And I think that the way that it's being reported is that another thing is happening in Baltimore, and that means that it's another Freddie Gray, or it's, you know, going to turn into a large scale burning of institutions or businesses. And that's just not the case. And it's, you know, like, even with the Pennsylvania Avenue vigil that happened last week?
I don't remember the timing, but I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And they were like, you know, it was in a scene reminiscent of Freddie Gray. And I'm like, yeah, but these people are just mourning their friend, like, who lived across the street from Shake and Bake. And they were just out there. The cops were out there, too, to make sure that people were being protected and not to escalate the situation. But the situation wasn't going to escalate unless, you know, there was some sort of random incidents that made it escalate, as was the case with Mondawmin, with the kids getting out of school and the cops being there and the rumor of the purge and all of these competing, you know, elements that sort of all coalesce in the same situation. That just doesn't happen here because people get angry or frustrated. Like, if you consider the length of time between the 68 riots and what happened last year, that's like almost 40 years, maybe over 40 since, you know, some large scale public unrest occurred here. Like, yeah, so we don't do that a lot. And I think that's something that definitely the media got wrong about Freddie Gray.
Are there particular challenges or advantages that come with being a freelancer living in Baltimore as opposed to a media hub like New York?
I think there are some advantages in terms of cost of living. Probably, if I'm being completely honest, New York and Washington have opportunities that a smaller market may not have. But it's also impossible to live there as a freelancer. Whereas here, you can sort of live as a freelancer. It's still somewhat affordable, and there are safe places you can live that are affordable in Baltimore that you don't have in the other markets. In terms of challenges, there are some things that you don't get to participate in if you are outside of town, things that happen or break immediately or things that you might want to be a part of and you can't be. So I feel a little bit of FOMO about not being in New York sometimes. D.C. is pretty close, so you can always get down there if you really want to. But yeah, I don't necessarily feel like there are challenges. I'm missing out on a lot as a professional person. Sometimes as a social person, I do feel like I'm missing out on connecting with other writers by being in Baltimore.
Also, it seems like just competition-wise, it might be advantageous to be one of the fewer freelance writers in Baltimore who writes on a national scale. Do you feel that?
Not really. Like, I don't know. I don't really return to a lot of the things that I write. I'm writing, like, at a breakneck pace a lot of the time. And just the other day, I did something horrible and, like, Googled myself. So, and I looked at all the things that came up, like bylines that came up, and I was like, I forgot I wrote for them. And I have a list of bylines on my blog, but I never go to it unless I'm writing for a new place and I want to add it. And when I do that, I always look like, wow, I've written at a lot of places at this point, because I haven't really been doing that type of writing for a really long time. So for a while there, for about 2 years there, I was really trying to hustle and get published everywhere. And I thought that was the most important thing, to just be published in a lot of different prominent publications at least once. And a lot of the list of my byline stuff will have like one or two things. I'm not like a consistent writer for anyone except maybe one publication right now. It used to be two that I wrote weekly for, and now it's just one. But yeah, I don't really think about it very much. I just think about constantly being able to be published, and I just want to be published in places I'm proud for my work to appear.
And the place you're weekly now is the Washington Post, right?
Yes.
And you're writing about pop culture there?
I am.
Well, I would like to talk a little bit about your, well, not your most recent, because you've obviously been writing a lot, but your most recent big project, which is your podcast, The Rise of Charm City. It launched in January, and you've done 10 episodes so far. Can you tell me a little bit more about the podcast and how that came to be?
So last year when I was freelancing exclusively, like freelance writing exclusively, I got an email from someone from AIR. It's the Association for Independence in Radio, and they were having a sort of competition. They were looking for independent radio producers with or without radio experience to pitch projects that would partner them with public radio stations in cities across the country. You could move if you wanted to, or you could stay where you were. And I think they were interested in having a Baltimore-based story because it was in the immediate aftermath of Freddie Gray. So it just seemed probably like a timely thing for them to select a public radio station based here and select a writer or radio person based here. And the deadline was like a week from when I got that email. So I think they were just really trying to get a lot more people on the indie side to submit. So I did that like on a whim, and I became a finalist. And WEAA was also a finalist on the public radio station competition side. So they partnered us, and we refined the idea, which turned into Baltimore, The Rise of Charm City. And that's pretty much the short version of that.
Can you describe the concept?
Yes. So Baltimore, The Rise of Charm City is a radio show slash podcast that takes us to different locations around the city. And we ask about the history of that place. We find out how long it's been there. And we talk to people who remember it either when it opened or remember it, you know, several decades ago, hopefully. And we also talk to people who are younger and still frequent the institutions or still live in the communities if we're doing a community.
Were those stories that you think, you know, weren't being told before this podcast, or what void were you trying to fill with this?
I don't think that any of the stories that we've told haven't been touched on, but I don't think that they have gotten a lot of in-depth attention. So, for instance, we did Shake and Bake first because Shake and Bake is a place that I'm familiar with, a place that I've been to a couple times as a young person, and it's an institution I knew had been there for a long time, but I didn't know the history of it, like, at all. So I wanted to start there as a place to get my feet wet because I didn't really know much about how to investigate this sort of thing for audio. And we tracked down the founder, who was a Baltimore Colts player, Glenn Dowdy, and he lives in St. Louis, so we had to call him and record the phone call and things like that. But I had no idea what we were going to find out from him, and it wound up being a really, really compelling story. One that I hadn't seen written out anywhere, even though I've read really comprehensive stories about Shake and Bake in City Paper and in other places. So I know that the work has been done in some ways, but probably not in this medium. Or we talked to him for 45 minutes. We didn't include all 45 minutes, of course, because we're a half-hour program. But getting that information and being able to sit with people and really promote their own voices instead of how I would interpret it or how I would summarize it in writing has been really valuable work. And I think that that's probably the void that's being filled. The fact that we're not just reporting stories, but also collecting oral histories from people who were there or who saw things firsthand, and being able to present that in a very public way as opposed to it being sort of in the archives of a college or university or some other place.
In my anecdotal experience, it also seems like people from Baltimore just love Baltimore history more than anywhere else I've lived. Our historical stuff does really well, too. Just, I don't know, have you experienced that also?
Yeah, and once you sit down with people, you kind of know who's been talked to a lot about the history of a place and who hasn't, because they're so eager to share and they really care so much about that history and getting their version of events down or documented. So yeah, in terms of just consumption, people love Baltimore history, and in terms of being able to contribute to it, I think that's really valuable for a lot of people. And we try to get people whose voices both would be heard a lot, like the president of a Harbor Bank of Maryland, and then also people who wouldn't be heard much at all, like someone who's been, who's 80 and has been skating at Shake and Bake since like 1983. So it's, I don't know, it's valuable work and it's good work. I think people enjoy it. So I'm very proud to be a part of that.
And you don't have a background in radio or podcasting, do you?
Not at all. This was like my very, very first radio experience in terms of, I'd been interviewed for radio, but I've never been someone who created anything that was audio based at all. So
how are you liking that? And do you see yourself doing more going forward?
I really, really love it more than I thought I was going to. So I really do hope to be able to continue doing both the Baltimore, the Risers Charm City project for season two, and then actually other projects. Podcasting's sort of huge right now, or is getting there, especially the storytelling narrative side of it. So that might be a good place for fiction to come back into play, or creative nonfiction to sort of be experimented with in ways that I can't necessarily do it just in print.
Have you secured funding for season two?
We have not, but we're having a live show / fundraiser next week. So we are hoping to raise awareness about the project and our intent to continue doing it, and hope that we can get funding through making people aware that we need it. So that's pretty much it.
Without spoiling anything, are there any stories or any areas you really like to explore going forward with the podcast?
Yes. So we want to talk about hospitals. We haven't done historic hospitals in the city. There was one of the first things we did when this project started was we took a riding tour with the Druid Hill YMCA. They offer it once a month to anyone, and I wasn't aware of that, so I'm saying it so that people will know about it. If they want to take the little bus tour, it's so cute. But but they took us past where Provident Hospital used to be, and Provident Hospital was apparently a segregated hospital. It was just for the Black residents of the city, and it was the only place they could go, I think, on that side of town, and or possibly all over the city, I'm not sure. But if we do that for season two, which we intend to do, we would investigate that and try to find people who were born there, and there are a ton of people who were, and there was a larger hospital that white citizens of the city could go to. And they are, on Twitter, we've heard from different people actually on the same day who were like, I was born at Provident, and everybody else was born at this other hospital that I can't remember the name of right now. But I wanted to tell sort of a story about the juxtaposition of those two institutions. We also want to do Cherry Hill stories. We didn't get to go to Cherry Hill, and we wanted to do a Highland Town story this year, and we didn't get to it. So Domino Sugar is like a big deal. Also funeral homes in the city. Funeral homes are, I don't know, you don't really get a whole lot on floral situations. There are a lot of old, really old florists in the city, and also a lot of old family-owned, Black-owned funeral homes that I'd like to explore possibly in the same episode. So those are some things we're hoping to do in addition to some other stuff.
Kind of to backtrack a little bit and go back to the writing side of your career, I read that you have moved away from writing about your personal life so much. I was hoping you could tell me more about why.
Sure. So I started freelancing professionally about, I don't know, it was 2013. So it's been 3 years now. I started out writing about my personal life because the first piece that I wrote was about single motherhood, particularly Black single motherhood. And that was one of my beats, so to speak, back then, because I had a blog that was a community space for single mothers of color. And
that was Beyond Baby Mamas.
Yes, Beyond Baby Mamas. So writing about my personal life when I was a newer mother, when my daughter was younger, was something that was really important to me because it was a big change in my life. And I find that new mothers who were writers before tend to write a lot about the personal experience of adapting to motherhood early on. And some people stick with it and make that a lifelong pursuit, trying to nail down what it means to be a mother in whatever personal sense they interpret it. That's something that I discovered in the past 3 years is not something that I want to publicly interrogate. So in my personal life, I don't necessarily want to talk so much about what it means to be a mother or a single mother, or a creative mother, someone trying to balance things. It's something I don't mind. It's not like against writing about it at all, but it's not something that I want to be paid to write about, or I have to write about it in order to earn a living. Like, I don't want my personal life to be something that I have to mine for content. So if I choose to write about it, I'm happy to do it. I try to give it my all, but I don't necessarily want to have to do that. So learning how to do other things and learning how to be more journalistic, which I was not trained to do, those are things that are important for me just so that I'm growing as a creative person and growing as a writer. And writing personal essays is something that comes to me pretty naturally, but it's not necessarily something I want to attach to earning or something that I want my income to rely on.
Well, I feel like this is kind of coming to a fever pitch on the internet, because 3 years ago, I mean, it was all personal essays. That was all the rage. And now there are a lot of people arguing there are too many personal essays online. They're oversaturated and, you know, they can't stand in for real reporting. But you still have other people publishing fantastic personal essays online and vouching for their importance in, you know, giving often marginalized communities a voice. I mean, what side of the coin are you on there?
Both sides. Yeah. So the coin spinning on the table. I think that personal essays are really empowering for a lot of different people. And I think that there is no shame in writing, making a profession of writing about your personal life. And I feel like a lot of people do that beautifully. And you can do it. You can earn a ton of money at it if you would like. Not a ton, but you can earn a living that way. And I do think that the mix of reporting and first-person narrative is something that can be extremely compelling. And I think that just in general, we seem to be trending toward that journalistically, I think, and have been for a long time. So the reporter putting themselves in the narrative somehow in a long-form piece of reported writing is something that has become less frowned upon or rare. And I advocate for that. I enjoy that kind of work sometimes. And I enjoy reading it especially. But yeah, in terms of just quick takes on the internet or just writing about on a weekly basis, trying to figure out what I have experienced or thought about in a week that I would feel comfortable sharing with people, I just don't want to do that. I don't think that there's anything wrong with anybody else doing it, of course. It's just not for it. I've learned that it's not for me over time.
What's next for you? What haven't you done yet that you'd like to do?
Probably publish a book. That's been a long term goal of mine. Yeah, so that's something that I'd like to work on. I'm not sure what else is next. I've done a lot. But it's like I've done a lot in short periods of time, and I haven't done anything that I could that I feel I could settle into and make a profession of. And I feel like I'm not a millennial, but I feel very millennial in that experience, like in terms of not being able to find a job that I can settle into, which is actually a desire of mine. I would like to work somewhere full time now at this point, because of how long I've been doing contractual work. And I've made that clear. I've gone on interviews for like full time jobs and stuff, but I just can't seem to land one. So if I were able to do that, I feel like I could probably explore the fiction writing a little bit more on the side, as opposed to trying to make space for it while I'm hustling through the things that I definitely have to write in order to be paid. So yeah, I think the book writing is something that's on the table sometime. I'm not really like pressed about it though, but it is something that I would like to accomplish in life.
That's interesting to hear, because from an outsider's perspective, it very much looks like you've settled into a successful freelance career, but I guess that doesn't come with the same security at all as a full-time job.
It does not. But then I have a lot of friends that have full-time jobs and don't feel very secure right now in this landscape. So, I mean, like as writers or as media people. And I just feel like I'm not sure even at this point whether or not a full-time job is the better option. So because I wanted to wait until my daughter was like in school full-time, like all day, before I went back to a full-time job. But I started interviewing for full-time jobs like a year ago because I just wanted to be able to have some more stability. Like, just felt like that might be the better thing. And it's always hard to try to figure out what the better thing is going to be. But yeah, I always enjoy what I'm doing in the moment that I'm doing it. And then when it's over, I enjoy the next thing that I'm doing. So hopefully that's going to continue to be the trend. I really hope it is.
Stacia, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Stacia Brown. Female Trouble is available on our website, baltimoresun.com. as well as on iTunes, SoundCloud, and all the major podcast apps. If you are listening on iTunes, you can help out the podcast by subscribing and giving us a rating. Follow at FML Trouble for all of our updates on Twitter. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty, featuring Baltimore's TT the Artist. See you next week. Keep